Hello, I'm Jeff Horwich, and this is The Week from In the Loop. Well, happy Halloween, or as we in the news media like to celebrate it, happy Hackneyed Play on Words Day.
I imagine it's scary if you owe more on your home than your house is worth.
And whether or not those retailers are in for a trick or a treat.
For details on the ailing bats, you can swoop into NPR.
If you're just dying to see pictures of the coffin couches, by all means, visit our website.
All right, well, I don't know if I'm good enough to join the club, but how's this? With the financial sector in a grave state and the election creeping up on us, could it be we've been ghoulishly whistling past the graveyard as our economy sank deeper into the pits of hell? Anyway, that's Halloween media speak for saying we've actually been in a recession now for the past 3 months, at least 3 months. That was this week's big but not so surprising revelation. Nevertheless, this was the week, kind of seemed to me, that we all seemed to kind of get used to it. I can feel this sense of acceptance that we're settling in now for a gloomy economic future for a little while. Of course, that'll mean shifts in our work life and in our pocketbooks. We may also be looking at some significant changes to our popular culture. We have consulted Nancy Robinson before on the show. She's a professional trend watcher. Big companies like MTV and Microsoft pay her to identify cultural changes before the rest of us catch on. We have paid her nothing to come in and talk about how our budding recession is shaping her world. Nancy, thanks for joining us.
Sure, and you get what you pay for.
That bodes well for the following 4 or 5 minutes. Let's just run through some categories here, like fashion, for example.
Well, it's interesting, but there is actually historical research in this area. So there's been the lipstick theory, the hemline theory. Lipstick theory meaning when the economy goes down, the lipstick gets brighter and brighter, more in the red area, more severe.
Oh, maybe trying to cheer ourselves up or something. The hemline theory, though, works in kind of the opposite way, right?
Yes. Supposedly, when times are good, hemlines are high, and also cleavage becomes a bit more visible. When times are bad, people tend to cover up. When we are coming into a recession, this is a very popular topic for people to talk about, and they're looking for any kind of measurement as possible. So there are people who've been studying pop songs during economic hard times. What kind of music do people tend to listen to?
Well, what do we know? Let's talk about music.
Well, currently the theory is that when times are bad, lyrics become more and more important. It's less about the bouncy beat and more about something that seems more relevant and reflective to personal experience.
Who are some lyric-challenged artists that may need to up their game if they want to keep it up during the downtimes?
Well, we'll see. Brittany's new album's coming out soon.
That's right. What's the name of her new song? Womanizer. Yes. I'll have to go check out the lyrics to that one, I suppose, and put that together with the hemline theory and see what it adds up to.
Well, I'm sure just watching a video, one of her videos, will do that.
What are we seeing on television right now? We got a new fall season of TV. Is there stuff out there that you think is going to do especially well when people are thinking about hard times?
Well, what's interesting to me right now is that we seem to be very interested in the idea of redemption. We're looking at a way to feel responsible, and we're looking for people to claim responsibility or at least be willing to change. Makes perfect sense when we're looking at such large bailouts across the country.
Mm-hmm.
So one way of looking at that would be in terms of reality television. The reality TV that's clicking with people is reality television that has some kind of story of redemption. Someone's making a choice here. They can either continue to do really bad things, or they can make a change and do good things. Going from My Super Sweet 16 to a reality spinoff.
Now, what was My Super Sweet 16 on MTV?
My Super Sweet 16 was an incredible look at 16-year-olds and some 15-year-olds planning multi-million-dollar 16-year-old parties.
Ah, these very, very rich girls planning these Sweet 16 parties.
And boys. Actually.
Yeah. Well, so there's a revival of the show, or what's going on?
There's a twist on the show this year. So some of those party princesses have now been duped into thinking that, one, they're getting a vacation, but in this reality show, they're being sent not to Bimini or to Monaco, but to, say, a small village in Africa where they're going to be digging trenches for 2 weeks.
Wow. How are the girls taking it?
Initially, not so well. But again, this is where redemption becomes great. By the end, of course, they're very happy to go back to their Louis Vuitton, but at the end, they're talking about how much they've learned and how much they've grown.
Okay, so it sounds a little like The Simple Life, that Nicole Richie and Paris Hilton show from a few years back,
yes.
Except in these times, I guess maybe we care now whether the girls actually become better people at the end of it.
Yes, one can only hope.
I guess our American culture is always evolving. We like to think, I guess, it's going somewhere. We're improving as a people, maybe. When the economy gets tough, does the evolution of our culture suffer?
You know, I'd actually argue that when things are down, the idea of ingenuity suddenly becomes much more valuable and creativity becomes more valuable. And that, to me, right now, is most exciting. The 30-something, the under 40-age consumer, they're in constant creative mode, which I think right now is something that's actually is ripe to be appreciated.
A lot of that deeper creativity can maybe get buried underneath the Britney Spears and the bling-bling that dominates during up times?
Yes, we've had a lot of economic noise in terms of buy, 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 and now we have a quieter economy with a lot of opportunity to look at different ways of living, different ways of buying, different ways of making.
Nancy, thanks for thinking through some of this stuff with us.
My pleasure.
Nancy Robinson is a trend watcher with Iconoculture. More about them at, you guessed it, iconoculture.com. This is The Week. I'm Jeff Horwich. Before we move on, I thought we'd give some updates on a few stories we've looked at on the show in recent months. Back in May, long time ago, seems like, we talked about what at the time was the largest ever immigration raid on a single facility. It's a kosher slaughterhouse in Postville, Iowa. This week, the hammer started coming down on the company itself. First, a $10 million fine from the state of Iowa for alleged labor law violations. Those included not paying wages to many of the workers who were seized in the raid. Then, yesterday, the former CEO was arrested and charged with conspiring to harbor illegal aliens and aiding and abetting identity theft. The charges together could mean more than 20 years in prison for the guy. And I'll mention the passionate reaction on both sides of an interview I did a couple weeks ago with a guy named Gus Booth. He's a pastor up in northern Minnesota who is testing the IRS by endorsing John McCain from the pulpit. One guy emailed to say the interview was putrid. How could you give this misguided freak a dandy pulpit to preach at us unchallenged? Another listener said, "Once again, Jeff, you let your interviewees get away with murder." And then there is the other side. I kind of like this side better. Best show so far. I love the pastor interview. Awesome radio. Here's another one. My wife and I cheered you on asking the pastor for the math. Fabulous. And here's one more. I'm listening at this moment to your broadcast from this week. Fabulous. People seem to like that word, fabulous. Best line so far, do you have the math handy? Now, I won't explain right now that math question people are talking about. You'll have to go listen for yourself. Go to minnesotapublicradio.org/intheloop. Look for our show from October 10th. And by the way, I would contend that we were extremely challenging to Gus Booth, but I wasn't rude or dismissive, which is what I'm sure some of his critics would prefer. And he's making news up there in War Road, Minnesota, which is why we talked to him. This is The Week. I'm Jeff Horwich. Find us online. We would love to hear your thoughts. And we like getting your creative submissions, which is where we are going next. We have a listener out in Bozeman, Montana. His name is Craig Kenworthy. We've had some of his poetry on the show before. And as Craig was thinking about the election, and this being Halloween, of course, he sent us this riff on the Edgar Allan Poe classic, read for us by Tom Keith. Sound man and actor with a Prairie Home Companion. Tom, take it away.
Once upon a ballot near me, while I pondered bleak and bleary, alone and unsure who to vote for, with my pencil I was tapping, and suddenly there came a rapping, rapping on the voting booth door. Quote the pundits, "What's the score?" Commentators, experts, enough of you and all your huffing. I'll decide without your puffing between Biden and Barack Obama, McCain and the one who is the mama. Leave me be with this my sacred chore. Still again, the others waiting. In my head I was debating plumbers, taxes, stocks still tanking. Which one means a chance that someday my kids will thank me? Who do I pull the little lever for? Quote the pundits, "Hey, we can't wait no more." All of you, your shouting started, making me so downward-hearted. Still, while stepping from the curtain of this, I am so, so certain. No matter who won this war, they've got to be better than the one before.
An election-inspired riff on Poe's The Raven from listener Craig Kenworthy in Bozeman, Montana, read for us by Tom Keith of A Prairie Home Companion. There is no easy segue out of that into our next segment, so I will not even attempt one. Officials from 20 countries are coming to the U.S. in November to talk about the world financial crisis. And in recent weeks, this thing has been often referred to in the press as another Bretton Woods. That term has been tossed around a bunch. Now, understanding that would require knowing what the first Bretton Woods was. Maybe that's a term left way in the back of your brain from a history or economics class you had. That's what it was for me. I've got Sebastian Malaby on the phone. He directs the Center for Geoeconomic Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. So you can bet he actually knows what this means. Sebastian, thanks very much for talking with us.
Great to be with you.
So Bretton Woods, in a very literal sense, it's a place in the middle of the forest in New Hampshire. In 1944, leaders from all over the world came there to a big hotel to do what?
Well, there were 44 countries represented, and what they came to do was essentially to create the economic conditions for avoiding another world war. It was in 1944, so the Second World War was still going on, and so Bretton Woods was primarily convened to create a stable exchange rate regime so that currencies would not fluctuate crazily, and you could have a basis for free and open trade, and the idea was that commerce would lead to peace.
And it's easy today to be cynical, I suppose, when the world's leaders get together and for a summit or something to try and get something done. But this is regarded as successful by just about everybody, right?
That was indeed regarded as a great success. Much of the architecture of the international order was created in this moment at the end of the Second World War. Since then, I think, we've moved into a much more complex world where partly power is less concentrated in the United States. Private capital flows dwarf government capital flows, private trade dwarfs anything the government can do. And so power is basically moved away from Washington, and it's harder for Washington to create institutions like they did at Bretton Woods.
So who's asking for another Bretton Woods in this moment in history?
The idea for another Bretton Woods conference began about a month ago from Britain, from Prime Minister Gordon Brown. The French jumped on the bandwagon. The Sarkozy, the French president, came to Washington to persuade President Bush to host it. The day before he arrived, the White House was assuring me that they would on no account agree to this crazy idea. And then the day afterwards, they decided that they would do. So I think a lot of countries sort of just didn't feel like opposing the idea of the summit. And now that they've agreed to it, they have to figure out what they'll actually use that meeting for.
Now, is the phrase another Bretton Woods really a good way to describe what's going to happen?
Well, if we knew what they were going to discuss, it would be easier to answer your question. But the truth is they're kind of making that up as they go along. There's a bunch of things that they could try to discuss in terms of fixing global finance to prevent another credit crisis. You know, one thing they could try to do is say, gee, you know, we've got China in particular, a huge economy these days, sitting on an amazing $2 trillion worth of reserves, whereas the International Monetary Fund, which is supposed to be the bailout agency for these crises, which are now spreading to, you know, Brazil and South Korea and so on, the International Monetary Fund only has roughly one-eighth of what the Chinese have. So I think a legitimate reform for a Bretton Woods II conference would be to say, gee, let's get some of that Chinese savings into the IMF where it can be used to stabilize the international system. But I just don't see the Chinese being terribly excited about agreeing to that.
So the first time around, it was the U.S. that needed to put its strength behind this new monetary system and come to the world's rescue. China was not really a player at all. But Bretton Woods II, if we can call it that, will be all about trying to get China to step up and play that role.
That's right. In 1944, the big creditor power was the United States. Today, it is China. And that's why we need to get China into the system and ask China, what do you want in exchange? And they might want a lot more influence within the International Monetary Fund, or they might want something else. But I think that's a conversation that needs to happen.
And remind me, where are they meeting?
They're going to meet November. In Washington, I think.
Oh, okay. Well, there's no sort of exciting, distinctive name like Bretton Woods we can attach to it, I suppose.
No, if only they were going off to some, you know, lonesome hotel in the middle of a forest in New Hampshire, it would be more evocative.
Boca Raton or something like that, that 60 years from now we'd be referring back to. Well, I think this has been quite helpful. Sebastian, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Sebastian Malaby is with the Council on Foreign Relations. He is also a columnist for The Washington Post. I'm Jeff Horwich, and this is The Week from In the Loop. Markets were up today, but one thing is for sure, after all this, Wall Street has certainly lost a lot of its swagger. Individual investors are intimidated, to say the least. Our producer, Sandon Totten, is with me now in the studio. Sandon, thanks for coming in.
Yep, sure thing.
Now, we asked you to check in with a couple of distinct investor groups and sort of see how they're feeling about what the market's been doing lately. And so who did you talk to?
Well, the first place I checked out is something called an investment club, which is basically a group of people. They've got some money and they start pooling it together and throwing it around the market. In this case, it was a group of all women. And the club says they're kind of like Wall Street in that they got money and they invested. But as one of their members, Mary Texer, puts it, unlike Wall Street, their group is
far more scientific and disciplined than they are.
They have as much fun.
Yeah. They take it, you know, that's their work. That's what, you know, they're very, very serious. We have a lot of fun. I don't think they have very much fun.
Now, Sandon, I wouldn't think that this would be a particularly fun time to be investing.
Sometimes it helps to laugh away the pain, I think. Mm. But overall, their portfolio, yeah, it's not doing great at all. It's probably getting the lowest returns they've ever seen. It's just down in the dumps. You know, usually they use this group as a way to kind of be detached from the market a bit. You know, it's not as much money as their entire savings, so they can play around with it, get a little adventurous.
Well, I guess if you're in a mood to be adventurous, people are saying that now is the time to get in there and scoop up some bargains, buy low.
Right. I mean, that's the common sense. And everyone knows that kind of on the surface. But I think even this group in their hearts, it's kind of hard to really get behind that. As one member, Jane Kemp, points out, right now, the market and all its trials and tribulations feels really personal.
I've been rocked the last month, you know, the way the market's behaved. I'm 55 years old, and, you know, I worry on my own personal retirement, is 10 years enough time to recover from what's just happened or what will be happening? I guess, you know, it's the uncertainty. It's gotta improve, doesn't it? I mean, please, you know.
Do you get the sense that being in this investment club helps these women better understand what caused the problems on Wall Street?
Well, they kind of chalk it up to, you know, greedy brokers and corrupt CEOs making a lot of havoc for the rest of us. So in their club, they try to take a stand against all that, try not to repeat the same mistakes as Wall Street. They do what they call values investing. Karen Staggy, one of the members, puts it this way.
Obviously, the point of this club is to learn and to hopefully earn some money along the way, but I don't think you do it at the cost of your morals.
We're going to stick to companies that are green, that companies that are treat their employees correctly. Then we can look at ourselves in the mirror and we'll be okay.
That's Mary Texer again.
Kind of the leader of the investment club.
Right.
Okay, so that's kind of the view for Main Street investors. Where did you find the Wall Street mentality still alive and kicking?
Right in our own backyard, actually, not too far from here. And they even start their market day with a bell. It's just a slightly different bell. We're in Stillwater Area High School right now in a marketing class where a bunch of students are taking part in something called the stock market game. It's a national competition where students are given $10,000, 10,000 fake dollars, and told to invest it however they want, as long as they can make as much money as possible. That's the point of the game. And here's a taste of their strategies.
Big stocks, big stocks.
The first day we just bought like companies that we knew of.
Google, Microsoft.
Walmart and...
And Nordstrom's.
Basically, we just look online and see which ones are going up.
Delta Airlines.
Apple. Like way up and we buy them.
It's always basically just luck.
First we did solar, but now it's like plummeted.
We're switching it around.
We don't have any solar anymore.
I don't know what else we have. We got a lot.
Must be a tough time to be learning about the market. Are they basically just learning what ulcers are?
Actually, the cool thing about it is some of these students have been making money in the down economy.
Really? How are they doing that?
Well, you know, some quick turnaround stocks, a whole lot of luck, and a bit of short selling.
Okay, so short selling is basically betting that a stock price is going to go down. That's a pretty aggressive tactic.
Right, not the most optimistic thing to do, but, you know, the point of the game here is to get ahead whatever it takes. In fact, some of the students have noticed that the competitive edge was making them feel a little bit of that good old-fashioned Wall Street greed. Here's Amanda Johnson.
Yeah, when we got in, like, third place, we were so mad. We just wanted to be in first place. And people wanted to, like, they were asking us, like, what stocks we were buying, and we would not tell them. We would, like, hide our folder because we didn't want anyone seeing what we were doing.
Do you worry at all you're going to learn the same lessons that sort of got Wall Street in this mess in the first place?
Yeah, sort of.
After spending some time with these students, what do you think they are actually learning from this?
Well, they're getting a taste of the market, you know, basically how it works and kind of how fickle it can be. And for some of them, it's teaching them that even right now, when the future looks really grim, if you think big, you can still make it to the top. Here's Jenna Fabian.
Yeah, right now we were just watching The Apprentice with Donald Trump, and he was just showing, like, all the luxury you can have if you make it, like, as high as him, and it just makes me want to be just like him.
Maybe with a slightly better hair.
Oh, for sure. I'd look way better.
Bringing us some new and unusual voices from the investing world, or maybe the fake investing world anyway. Sandon Totten, producer of our show, thanks very much.
Yeah, no problem, Jeff.
This is The Week from In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich. The big presidential election, of course, is now just, 4 days away? And for a little music to end the show, I've been thinking about undecided voters. They are still out there. They're, of course, very important. And I've been thinking about decided voters and their very strong opinions about undecided voters. And so without further ado, a little barbershop quartet style number, I suppose. A song of the undecided voter and those who love them. Well, there's only days to go, and I'm still waiting. I've seen all the parading and debating, but I still don't have a clue.
What's wrong with you?
I'm taking time to make my pick.
You completely make us sick.
I just haven't heard enough on every policy position.
It's all up on their websites now, just make a damn decision.
They won't talk about the issues, it completely makes me crazy.
Oh, seriously, it's all up on their websites now, you're just being lazy.
Well, all the negativity just makes me so insane.
The fact that you don't know yet makes us question your brain.
And whichever way I go, don't know what difference it'll make.
Are you joking? The future of the country is at stake. When will you decide?
On election day, I guess. Suppose I have to vote for someone.
This is making us depressed.
I've got concerns about them both. Not sure who should get my nod.
But you still have to choose one. Do it for the love of God.
Why can't we have a candidate with all the things we need? An outsider who still has the experience to lead.
We can't believe we're hearing this, you don't make any sense. And if we could, we'd take our fist and punch you off the fence.
I'm just a guy who has a hard time making up his mind.
We're beginning to suspect that you don't give a rat's behind.
I'm still so undecided and I don't know what to do.
Why do these elections have to hinge on folks like you? On folks like you.
The Week is produced by Sandon Totten and me. We are edited by Kate Smith. Find us online at minnesotapublicradio.org/intheloop. I'm Jeff Horwich. Thank you for listening. Everybody have a good Halloween and, gosh, have a fun election next week, won't you?